This past summer at Camp High Sierra, we had a little bit of a war. We don't always get wars at camp, but we had a little bit of a war that took place. It was initiated by our junior campers. Our junior campers are the children of those who are working there at camp typically, and we have a small junior camper program that's run for those who are generally under the camp age, so younger than 12. The junior campers this year took some actions that initiated a little bit of a war with the kitchen staff. Initially, began with the junior campers setting up a mailbox, where this mailbox was sitting out on the front patio of the kitchen hall, and campers were encouraged to write notes of thanks to the kitchen staff and leave them in the mailbox. The kitchen staff, of course, was unaware of this going on, wasn't sure what the mailbox was for, until they had a nice load of thank you notes dumped in their laps, and they were a little bit overwhelmed and didn't quite expect it and appreciated it. They retaliated, though. So the kitchen staff responded the next junior camper's activity by providing them some special snacks, which the junior campers then took as a further escalation. So for their next craft activity, they created some little butterfly snack bags that they went and delivered to the kitchen staff. Kitchen staff, of course, they escalated again. So the next junior camper's activity that they had access to, they brought them cookies covered in whipped cream and toppings and all sorts of delicious stuff. The junior campers were not to be outdone. So for their next craft activity, they created origami flower bouquets that they then brought to the kitchen staff. And the kitchen staff, admitting defeat, wrote cards of thanks to the junior campers. Turn over to Hebrews 10. It's a funny example. They referred to this as their love war. And it took place over the course of many days at camp, and it became known as their love war. And this kind of thing we're actually encouraged to do, we're told to do. Hebrews 10 and verse 24 says, "And let us consider one another in order to provoke to love and to good works," your translation might say stir up, "not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much more as you see the day approaching." At camp this past summer, we saw this. We got to see this, right? They were provoking one another to love and to good works, right? And they seem like trivial things. They are small things, right? But they were displays of affection, and there was a good bond between the junior campers and the kitchen staff, as they all had these exchanges back and forth. And they were provoking one another to show it, to prove it, to demonstrate it. So let's take a look at this concept today. We're going to look at these two verses and spend a lot of time right here in these, considering the meaning and what it is that they mean for us, what we need to be doing. Paul, we're assuming it's Paul that wrote the book of Hebrews. I assume it's Paul. So if I say, "when Paul says," that's the assumption being made. But Paul says here, we're jumping in the middle of a thought, but he says, "let us consider one another." This is where he starts. Let us consider one another. Now when we think about considering one another, we might jump to the idea of being considerate, which in our society is not quite what the intent is here, right? When we think, "oh, we'll be considerate," it means I will hold the door for so-and-so. I'll go open the door for my wife so she can get in the car. I'll let some guy cut in front of me on the freeway so that he can, you know, have some space. That's our idea of being considerate. And those things are good and nice, and we should be doing those things, of course. But it's not simply that notion of being considerate. It's not just, "oh, thinking about. Oh, consider someone. Oh, I'll think, okay." It's not a fleeting consideration. The word there means to observe fully. Observe fully. It's used a couple of other places in the Bible. Let's take a look at some of those. Turn over to Acts 27. This is a really interesting passage. In most ways, it has nothing to do with what we're talking about today. So let's go there. Acts 27, and in verse 39. So here's the background. Paul is on a ship in the middle of a storm, and they're anchored off of the coast of Malta. They're trying to brave out this storm, but they know that their ship has taken a beating and that it's not going to last very long. They know that they're going to sink, right? They're on the verge of total destruction and probably all drowning in the ocean in the middle of this storm. It was extremely stormy. If you look at verse 41, it says, they ran the ship aground and the prow stuck fast and remained immovable, but the stern was being broken up by the violence of the waves. So this is after they had driven the boat into shore. But the boat was actually broken up by how violent the sea was. Right? So this isn't that just, oh, there's rain coming down and it's kind of gloomy. They're in the middle of a really violent storm. It's pretty heavy. And they're anchored there off of the coast trying to figure out what they're going to do, trying to figure out how they're going to get through this and how they're going to live. They've been anchored there all night in the middle of this storm. And in verse 39, it says, when it was day, they did not recognize the land, but they observed a bay with a beach onto which they planned to run the ship if possible. Other translations say they discovered. It says they discovered a certain bay with a beach into which they were minded if they were able to drive the ship. This word discovered there or observed, that's the same word that we're talking about when we say, let us consider one another. So this wasn't just, oh, they considered this shore. They're in the middle of the ocean. They know they're about to die. And they're trying to find the one way that they can, you know, safely move aground and safely keep their ship intact long enough that they can get out and swim to shore. So they're very carefully considering their options here. And they're looking and they find this bay. And they found it, and they're debating. This is the one. This is right here. This is, look at it, observe it, see, we could probably get the boat right in here and it'll, you know, we'll be able to get to shore one way or another. This looks safe. Right? This is the kind of consideration that they were taking of that particular bay. That's the kind of consideration that Paul's talking about when he says that we need to be considerate of one another. It's not a, oh, so-and-so, that's right. I'm going to think about this person. Now, what about this? What if I were in their shoes? What would be good for them? What could I? It's that sort of consideration. It's a very deep, thoughtful consideration. And it's not a fleeting consideration. Turn over to James 1. The same word is used here. James 1 and verse 23. It says, for if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like a man studying his natural face in a mirror. Studying here, same thing. Now, men, you may not feel like you study your face in the mirror often. But you know you do. There are times that you'll stand there and look at yourself in the mirror and think, who's that guy? All right. I look good today. It's fully observing, right? You're taking notice of the fact that hair's out of place. What's that? What are those wrinkles all about? Whatever it is, you're fully observing and taking notice, usually in a way that not everybody's going to. Your hair looks out of place to you. It doesn't look out of place to anybody else because nobody notices the difference, right? But you know that whatever it is out of place. Because you're fully observing. You're fully taking in. So from that perspective, when he says, let us consider one another, you know, do we consider other people in the same way that we consider ourselves, in the same way that we consider our own needs? We think about we're very good at thinking about our own needs, right? But do we think about other people's needs in that same kind of way, with the same sort of depth, with the same sort of understanding of consequences and impact and what it might mean and considering the whole situation, right? This is obviously a pretty deep level of consideration. Philippians 2, don't need to turn over there, but I'll read it to you. It will probably sound familiar. Let each of you look out not only for his own interests, but also for the interests of others. Again, it's the same idea. Considering others as you would consider yourself. Because we're very good at considering ourselves. And he doesn't say, don't consider yourself. He uses that as a model, as an example. You know how to consider yourself. You know how to take care of yourself and think about your own needs. Do that same kind of thing when you're considering other people. That's what he's talking about. It's the second great commandment, really, right? Love your neighbor as yourself. Do it the same way that you would do for yourself. Let's continue in Hebrews 10, verse 24. He continues the thought, right? Let us consider one another to provoke to love and good works. This part is very interesting. Again, yours might say stir up love and good works. I like provoke because it's actually a little bit more in line with the sense of the word. Expositor's Bible Commentary says this about this word particularly. It says it usually has a meaning like irritation or exasperation. It is most unusual to have it used in a good sense, and the choice of the unusual word makes the exhortation more striking. So this is usually a bad thing, to provoke, the same as it is in our language. Stir up in English can mean either, right? Oh, he really stirred him up. Or, you know, stir up the spirit that's in you. That's a good thing. We understand that. Provoke, though, we don't generally tend to think of provoking people to any sort of good action. But that's what he's saying here. Provoke to love and good works. And he's saying you want to excite some action in other people. Provoking is really that prompting a reaction. It's getting a rise out of somebody. You say, that person really knows how to push my buttons. And that person really knows how to get to me. It's that sort of thing in a right and proper way. You know, imagine if somebody really knew how to get you to do good stuff. Right? That's what he's saying here. Provoking to love and good works. And that's the action he's talking about, right? When you provoke somebody, intentionally or not, you're provoking them to do something. Provoking them usually means you're provoking them to get angry. Provoking them to get that negative response, to show them you're right, to put them in their place, and you know that that's going to do something bad to them. But he's saying provoke them to these actions, to love and good works. That's the reaction you want to stir up in other people. You want to be able to provoke people in such a way that they're going to go out and love and do good things. That's what he's talking about. Because the two go hand in hand, right? Love and good works go hand in hand. If you can provoke people to love, the good works will follow. If you're that stirred up with actual love, right? Love is outgoing towards other people. The good works will follow that. And so he's saying you've got to try to be thinking along these lines, provoking people to love and the actions that follow that love. Now God actually set us an example in this provoking to love and good works. Let's turn over to Acts 2. Acts 2 and verse 36. We usually read this around Pentecost. This happened on the very first Pentecost. First New Covenant Pentecost, anyway. Acts 2:36. Peter here is speaking to thousands of those who are gathered there in Jerusalem. And he says, "Therefore, let all the house of Israel know assuredly that God made this same Jesus, whom you crucified, both Lord and Christ." And that prompted a reaction. He provoked them, right? He put the blame on them and said, "You crucified him." And he was stirring them up. Now, was he stirring them up just to load them with guilt? No. But he was stirring them up. And he was very effective in this, because it says, "In hearing this, they were stabbed in the heart and said to Peter and to the other apostles, 'Men and brothers, what shall we do?'" So he's stirring them up to act, to do something. And what does he want them to do? Peter said to them, Acts 2:38, "Repent and be baptized, every one of you, in the name of Jesus Christ, to remission of sins, and you shall receive the gift of the Holy Spirit." So he wanted them to react by demonstrating their love toward God, right? And the acts that follow that, the repentance that follows that, right? The baptism, the receiving of the Spirit, those things that follow that. So he's stirring them up to love and to good works. And interestingly, God then continues after baptism to stir us up by his Spirit. Right? This is something that God does continually. He provokes us to love and good works. His Spirit does that in us. It provokes us. It prompts us to do good things. God, in that sense, does try to get in there and push our buttons and stir us up to love. We'll get into some examples later. Let's continue in Hebrews 10. So let us consider one another, right? Hebrews 10:24. Let us consider one another to provoke to love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of yourselves together. And it's interesting that he inserts that idea, because when you go back and you look at the first half of what he said there, that none of that provoking to love and good works, none of that consideration is really possible without the assembling of ourselves together. You can't consider each other if you don't have some sort of regular interaction with each other, right? And that's part of what this meeting every week that God calls us to is for, right? We're here, we're together, we have fellowship, right? Which means we're able to interact with each other. We're in and out of each other's lives every week because we're here. We can consider one another. We hear about what people are going through. We hear the announcements, the prayer requests, and we understand there are all of these situations that our brothers and sisters are experiencing, and we can sit and consider some of those. Even during the announcements today, you were probably considering some of the people that have been affected and what it is that you can do about that. Right? And that's good and that's proper. That's the kind of consideration we have. But it requires that we're together. It requires that we have fellowship. We can't provoke each other without this sort of fellowship, without assembling. If we're not assembling as a group, then how do we provoke? This is sort of where it starts, and we follow up with interactions during the week. But this is really where we're able to be together, where we have this environment where it really fosters that, right? That we can provoke each other. You can't do that in isolation. Regarding love, Expositor's Bible Commentary points out, "It is interesting that this kind of love is thus a product of community activity. The love and the good works that Jesus Christ wants to see out of us is a product of community activity, for it is a virtue that requires others for its exercise. How can you practice love and good works in isolation? You can't, right? We have to be here. We have to have each other to practice with, right? To exercise love and good works. And then as we have opportunity to all people, of course. But this is where we work on it. This is where we're able to encourage it and help each other in it. So we see from this idea that proper provocation, being able to provoke each other to this, requires unity. Right? Not even simply just being together in the same room, but unity. Right? That we actually have to be one people together. And it requires consistency. Assembling isn't just a one-time event. Now, don't forsake the assembling of yourselves together. Well, I went to church once, so I've can check that one off the list. Assembling is ongoing. It's a continual thing that he encourages. Obviously, there are occasions we've had a lot of sickness. It's been flu season. So if you're sick, don't feel like you have to come. Right? This isn't talking about the one time where you can't be there. This is talking about your regular practice. Right? Is it your regular practice to be assembling? And to have that unity. Also to have the consistency. Right? It's part of what he's saying. Don't forsake the assembling of yourselves together. Make it regular. Be consistent. Right? What if you're not consistent? Right? What if we all were only here every other week? Then every other week, we'd have a very different kind of group of people that was here. We wouldn't necessarily be one body. It'd be very mixed and scattered. We wouldn't have the kind of connections that we need to have. So he's saying, you have to do this consistently. You have to do this ongoing. And when you do come together, you have to be unified. Turn over to Acts 2. We see some examples of this. Acts 2 and verse 42, again following up on the day of Pentecost, says, they were continuing steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine and in fellowship and in the breaking of loaves and in prayers. This is something they were doing continually. So they were together. Continuing with, verse 46, and continuing with one accord in the temple and breaking bread from house to house, they shared food with gladness and simplicity of heart, praising God and having favor with all the people. And the Lord added to the church daily those who were being saved. They had all of these things going together. Right? They were continuing steadfastly. Right? This was something they were doing consistently. They were in the apostles' doctrine. They were coming together. They had authoritative teaching. And they were following it. They were in fellowship. It says, in formal assembly, in breaking the loaves, so informal assembly with each other, they were still together, and in prayers, right? This is not even necessarily together that they were all praying, but in prayers, in the way that we'll say, we have been praying for so-and-so, right? It doesn't mean that we've all been standing in this room praying for someone, but it means that sometimes we collectively are praying for somebody individually in our rooms, in our houses. Right? So they were together in their prayers. They were unified. And in that type of environment, God was able to add to the church daily. He's able to add continually in that. Now, what was the result of all this assembling, right, and provoking to good works? Acts 4, verse 32, tells us, it says, all the believers were one in heart and mind. Acts 4:32. No one claimed that any of his possessions was his own, but they shared everything they had. There were no needy, verse 34. There were no needy persons among them. For from time to time, those who owned lands or houses sold them, brought the money from the sales, and put it at the apostles' feet, and it was distributed to anyone as he had need. So, as they were there together collectively, individuals were aware of the needs of the other people around them. They knew, they considered, they understood, this person has need, that person has need, this group has need. Right? And they were willing to give of themselves to fill the needs of others. Right? They were stirred up to love and good works. Continuing then in Hebrews 10. He says, as the manner of some is. The manner of some is to forsake the assembly of themselves together. And we have that today. We've had that for as long as the church has existed. Some people, for various reasons, will just not be a part of the regular assembling together. It's not healthy. Here in this situation, when he was writing to the Hebrews, it might have been due to persecution. They knew that persecution was on the rise against Jews and against Christians, and so maybe they would stop attending each week because they were worried about, you know, the Romans coming in and rounding them up and taking them away. And so they would forsake the assembly for that reason. Present day, there are many reasons, right, that people will not assemble regularly. And you've probably heard plenty of excuses and plenty of explanations for why people don't want to assemble regularly. We have some who cannot be here, right? That's different. There are those who would love to be here every week and would be here if they could and can't. That's not what he's talking about here. He's talking about those who could be here, who won't, who choose not to, who opt out. Eventually, that type will stray, will seek to pull you out with them. Right? They'll seek for you to also find some exemption, some reason that this verse doesn't actually apply to you and that you don't need to assemble regularly. Well, we have this little thing we do in our living room and we're two or three together, God's there and everything's covered. You're good. Right. There are those who will forsake the assembly and want you to follow. But for all the reasons that we've already talked about here, just in this little verse, it doesn't make sense, right? There's no way to justify that sort of activity. The next statement he says is, but exhorting one another. So not forsaking the assembly of yourselves together as the manner of some is, but instead exhorting one another, which again, you can't do without the assembling together of ourselves. Back in Hebrews 3, in verse 13, I'll just read it to you. He says, exhort one another daily, while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. Here, he's commanding daily encouragement, right? This even implies that we're more active with each other than simply here on the Sabbath, that what we do here is a big part of what we do, but it continues again throughout the week, that we're encouraging one another daily. And so much more as you see the day approaching. Our sense of urgency should fuel these actions. Time is short, and we know that. And we need the encouragement and the provocation as the time becomes shorter. We need, as things become harder and more difficult, we need more encouragement. We need more provocation. We need more stirring up and more interaction. So he's saying this is something, again, that's ongoing, requires consistency, requires that we're together. Romans 13 and verse 11. This was a constant theme of Paul's, this sort of urgency. Romans 13 and verse 11. He says, besides this, you know what time it is, how it is now the moment for you to wake from sleep, for salvation is nearer to us now than when we became believers. The night is far gone and the day is near. He's saying, you've got to be doing this stuff. There's no time to sit and just relax and we'll worry about this and we'll improve and I'll get better sort of bit by bit. No, he's saying this is urgent. Hop on this. Do this. You need it and the people that you're with need it. We need it. I need it. We need to be provoked. Now, there is a type of negative provocation. And there's one other spot in the Bible where this word for provoke that's used in Hebrews 10 is also used. Let's turn over there. Acts 15. Because if we're not considering one another, we may just naturally tend to provoke each other in a wrong way. There are those that tend toward negative provocation. I think human nature just tends toward negative provocation. We tend to sort of push people's buttons when they irritate us and provoke them in negative ways. Sometimes it's not even hostile. Sometimes it's just in the form of concern or whatever it is that people will stir you up to get you to do something that is contrary to what God wants you to do. And we've seen plenty of this, right? We've divided because of things like this, where people will say, well, I'm really concerned for you. You should go look at all of this nonsense and get real excited, get real angry about this, and then go do something that's completely contrary to what God says we should do, like split. Right? People can provoke us in very negative ways without being provocative or hostile. You'll recall that provoke means to stir up. So again, Acts 15, verse 37, let's take a look. Verse 36, we'll get some context. It says, after some days, Paul said to Barnabas, let us now go back and visit our brethren in every city where we have preached the word of the Lord and see how they are doing. Now Barnabas was determined to take with them John, called Mark, but Paul insisted that they should not take with them the one who had departed from them in Pamphylia, and had not gone with them to the work. So on a previous trip, John Mark had abandoned them. They were out doing the work. John Mark got homesick. He took off. And they were down one helper. Paul didn't want to deal with that again. He didn't want to bring John Mark. Barnabas, because John Mark was a relative, and because Barnabas was a very sort of encouraging type of person, he wanted John Mark to come along. Then the contention became so sharp that they parted from one another. And so Barnabas took Mark and sailed to Cyprus, but Paul chose Silas and departed, being commended by the brethren to the grace of God. The contention there, contention is that same word, provocation. The provocation, they became so stirred up about this issue that they actually split. And that's generally what happens. When people are provoked in a negative sense, it divides people. If you provoke me to anger, I probably don't want to be around you, and vice versa. We don't want to be around people that provoke us in this negative sense. We see the same sort of, well, a similar sort of provocation back in Eden. Genesis 3 and verse 1. And again, this is the same sort of thing. Now the serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, he provoked the woman, is it so that God has said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden? Here again, this is not a hostile, an overtly hostile anyway, sort of provocation. But he's stirring her up. Verse 4, you shall not surely die, for God knows that in the day you eat of it, then your eyes shall be opened, and you shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. He's saying, look, you should consider these things and think about these things because, you know, I'm concerned for you. And, you know, you might want to think about this. And he stirs her up to what? To love and good works? No. Right? He stirred her up to division from God. Separation from Eden. Difficulty between her and her husband and the children. And that, in general, is what that kind of negative provocation will stir up. It's the opposite of all the things that Paul talks about in Hebrews 10. Right? It causes division. It causes forsaking the assembly of yourselves together. Instead of love and good works, it causes love to wax cold. It causes people to grow weary in well-doing. And that sort of provocation has to be avoided completely. We find that love, one of the things in 1 Corinthians 13, it tells us about love in verse 5. It says, love does not seek her own and is not easily provoked. Love isn't easily provoked by those types of things. So when we find ourselves getting stirred up by something, we find ourselves really getting sort of riled up about something, we need to ask ourselves, what's the end of this? Is the end of this love and good works? Or is the end of this something else? Because if it's something else, then by this, we shouldn't be easily stirred up by those things. We shouldn't be easily provoked by these things. Somebody says to you, I think you should think about this kind of thing. You might want to think about this. So-and-so did this to you or to me or to somebody else. And that's really something that should bother you. What's the end result of that action? Is the end result of that action going to be love and good works? Or is it going to be division and contention and strife? But that sort of handling of those situations requires a certain maturity and self-control. And most importantly, God's guidance. And God being stirred up within you, right, to be able to handle those types of things in a way that is loving and will produce good works. Let's take a look at a couple of examples of positive provocation. We have quite a few in here. Let's turn over to John 21. Here at the end of the book of John, we have a very, very good example of exactly what Paul was talking about when he's saying provoking somebody to love and good works. John 21, Jesus Christ, this is after his resurrection, says, so when they had eaten breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me more than these? Now, if you're Simon Peter, and you know that you've betrayed Jesus Christ, that you denied him 3 times, you realize there might still be some unresolved issues here, and that you haven't addressed these things with him, and now he's bringing it up. And he says, Simon Peter, he says, Simon, do you love me more than these? He's provoking him a little bit, isn't he? He's saying, hey, How do you feel about this? And he's throwing it out there, and he's letting Simon Peter get a little bit stirred up about it. But why? Why? He asks him 3 times. And 3 times he tells him, feed my lambs. Feed my sheep. He's not doing this as a punishment. Again, he's not doing this for guilt. He's not telling Peter, you should feel really bad about denying me 3 times. Now, subtly, he asks him 3 times, right? And that's why Peter presumably was so grieved by it. But he wasn't doing this to prompt guilt. He wasn't doing this to say, Simon Peter, you should feel so bad that you denied me 3 times. I can't believe you would do something like that. What kind of friend are you? No, he provokes him, and he encourages him to act, to do something. to feed my sheep. He's using this opportunity of personal hurt, of betrayal, of something that Peter did. He's using it as an incentive for Peter to go out and demonstrate love and good works toward all the people that he was going to call. He took this opportunity to say, look, sort of demonstrate that personal hurt, personal betrayal didn't need to be something that was an opportunity for revenge. But he actually leveraged that to get Peter to do something good and positive. And he really turned that around. Let's look at another example. Let's turn over to the book of Philemon. There's only one chapter. Philemon is a book that Paul wrote to Philemon. Philemon was a recipient. And he wrote this because Philemon owned a slave. Slave's name was Onesimus. Slaves were common in the Roman Empire. About a third of the population was slaves. And Onesimus had run away from his master Philemon. Somehow, one way or the other, by God's hand, Onesimus found Paul in Rome. And Paul working with Onesimus, eventually Onesimus became converted, was baptized, was a helper there to Paul. And at some point, Paul became aware of the fact that Onesimus was a runaway slave and that his master just happened to be somebody else that Paul knew back in the church in Asia Minor, and that Paul had probably baptized. It's speculated Paul had probably, on one of his previous tours, been there and baptized Philemon himself. So Paul knows Philemon, and here's Philemon's runaway slave, Onesimus. Now, Paul is using this opportunity. He writes this letter to Philemon to encourage Philemon to bring Onesimus back, to accept him back, which was a pretty precarious situation in some ways. Runaway slaves were not well treated in Rome. At the very least, they would usually be beaten. Sometimes they were branded with an F, for the word fugitive. They could be killed. They were property. So this was not a common thing for a slave to just walk back into his master's door and say, here I am. And Paul knew it, and Onesimus knew it, and you have to imagine what that conversation must have been like when Paul said, hey, why don't you go back? And here he sends Onesimus back to Philemon with this letter in hand. But Paul here is demonstrating what he wrote in Romans when he says, provoke one another to love and good works, considering one another. He'd been very considerate here. When you read through this, you find that he was obviously considerate of the needs of Onesimus. He was very protective of Onesimus, and he describes Onesimus as his son and his helper, and someone who had been very profitable. And so he gives Onesimus a really good report in that sense, back to his master. He's considerate of the needs of Philemon, who here was going to have an opportunity to be tested, to either demonstrate what forgiveness and love could be, or to act on the standards of the day and to take the slave back and beat him and brand him and do whatever it is that they did to their slaves. You can tell he was also considerate of the church, because the church met in Philemon's house, and the church there, it says that Philemon was often refreshed. You'll see he says that. That the church was often refreshed by Philemon himself. Right? So he was somebody there who benefited the church. And Paul is sending him back, knowing that this opportunity is going to be something that the church would actually be able to observe and to see and have forgiveness and love demonstrated. And so that's what Paul is trying to stir up. He's trying to stir up this forgiveness and this action and this love. Verse 12, you can see that he's provoking him in a sense. He's provoking Philemon. He says, I'm sending him back. You therefore receive him, that is my own heart. He doesn't just say this is some slave, some guy coming back to you. He's prodding and poking Philemon a little bit and saying, this is my own heart. Verse 17. If then you count me as a partner, receive him as you would me. Again, testing him a little bit and saying, look, if you think of me highly, receive him like you would receive me. Putting it out there and prodding him a little bit. You know, because the other implication is if you're going to mistreat him, then that's an indicator to me that you would mistreat me also and mistreat my wishes. He says in verse 21, again, sort of stirring him up a little bit, having confidence in your obedience, I write to you, knowing that you will do even more than I say. So again, stirring him up to say, you know, there's more that you could do here that I'm not outlining explicitly. You go ahead and do that. Tradition has it that Philemon received Onesimus and freed him. And so he was no longer a slave. But you'll see that Paul didn't order him to do this either. This wasn't a command. Take a look at verse 8. He says, therefore, though I might be very bold in Christ to command you what is fitting, yet for love's sake, I rather appeal to you. So this wasn't compulsion. Verse 14, without your consent, I wanted to do nothing that your good deed might not be by compulsion, as it were, but voluntary. So you can tell he's provoking him here to do something. Not because Paul said you have to do this, but giving him opportunity to step out and do something bigger and better and greater than even what Paul had outlined here. Paul said receive him, but he leaves the door open for Philemon to have this opportunity to grow and to do even more. And again, Paul takes this situation and turns it around. He uses this personal loss of Philemon's as an opportunity to demonstrate love and good works, especially toward a brother, toward another member. We have many examples. There are other examples you'll take a look at. You could find, I'm sure. But we can extract some principles, some concepts from these examples. So there are things that we can do when we're talking about practicing this sort of provocation in our lives. Again, you can see they put a lot of consideration into their subjects. Jesus Christ, when he's there prodding Peter a little bit, he knew what he wanted Peter to become. He had this whole goal in mind for Peter. He had this idea of what he wanted Peter to be. And so he's very considerate of him and how he handles this situation. But he thought deeply about him. We can do this also. You and I can identify somebody in our life. This is something you can go out and do this week. Identify someone that is within your sphere of influence. Consider that person's needs. Consider that person's situation. Consider their opportunities for growth. Consider what it is. What kind of impact you could have on this person. Something that in some way will help them to develop spiritually. We see also that both Jesus and Paul here in these examples, they had a specific action that they wanted their subjects to take. Jesus said, go feed my sheep. Go take care of them. Paul said, I want you to receive him, and you can do even more. But he had that specific action in mind. He said, I want you to do this. Please do this. We have similar opportunities, as we're considering, right, and thinking about somebody else and what they might need, we can have specific actions in mind that we actually would like that person to take. Right? Not just a, oh, you need to be a better person. Why don't you go do that? Now, that's really not a very helpful sort of encouragement to someone. We know that. We know we need to be better people. But if we're considering someone, consider it of their needs, consider it of where maybe they could come along some, right? Without belittling them or putting them down, there are things that we could, there are actions that maybe we could see them taking, things that we could see them doing that might really help them to grow. One really good way to do this, to get somebody to go about doing something specifically, is to ask for help. Especially when you're asking for help for the benefit of a third party. And this is pretty much what we see Jesus doing. It's what we see Paul doing. Jesus goes to Peter and says, I want your help, essentially. I want you to feed my sheep. Help me do this for their good, for their sake. He asks for their help. Paul does this when he's writing to Philemon. He says, I need you to help me. This man's been valuable to me. I'm sending him back to you. I'm asking for you to help me to help him. Help me in this. And so he asked for help. Sometimes we might be aware of other people's needs. We might be aware of situations where somebody else really needs something, right? And we have, even just thinking about the announcements today, there are plenty of opportunities, right, for service. You might be aware of other needs. And you might be able to help bring somebody along or simply give somebody an opportunity to act, to do something, again, that's in line with those love and good works by inviting them to help fill those needs. You can call somebody up and say, I'm going to go do this. I was wondering if you could come along and help me. Or, I've got this in mind. I'd like to organize this or set this thing up. Would you take this part of it? I could really use your help. Right? You might not necessarily need that person's help. None of us are really indispensable. But you need or could use someone's help. And you can be considerate of what kind of growth opportunity that role might have, who might fill that well, who you might be able to include in something, and again, grow toward love and good works. Because again, that's what both Jesus and Paul did. They helped bring people along with them to do what they were already doing and included them in that and helped them in their personal growth. This love war that we had at camp, it was in an environment that was very easy to practice, right? We were isolated. We were all together every day, and we had opportunity to provoke each other every day to love and good works. Here, in this environment, in this world, it's different. We face different challenges. We're disconnected often during the week. We don't get to all be together every day during the week. We have those disconnections. Sometimes we're discouraged by our circumstances. There are things that bring us down, that make it hard to think outside of ourselves, especially thinking outside of ourselves to think about somebody else. Wow, that can be a lot of work. Sometimes we're distracted by activity. There's just this going on and that going on and this happening and that happening, this happening. And, oh yeah, I should think about somebody else in there. But those challenges actually also provide us opportunity to begin practicing this provocation. For example, if you're looking for a way to implement this, if you're looking for a way to encourage others, right, we can encourage more connectivity. And say, hey, I know so-and-so over here has been feeling really down. Why don't you and I go see them? If you thought about giving them a call, maybe write them a card, you send them an email, whatever it is. But we can use that sort of disconnectivity that we have just naturally in our society, as an opportunity to, for us to start encouraging each other and build each other toward those love and good works. Those who are discouraged, those who are down, are actually really good targets for some of this activity. Again, you could say, this person's really been down in the dumps. This person's really been hurting. Why don't we plan something? We'll get together. Let's include them. Make sure that they know, you know, that we appreciate them. You know, those who are busy, distracted, sometimes, and we all get there, when we get into those situations, sometimes we need someone to help us to put things on pause for a second, to recognize priorities, to say, oh, okay, I do need to go do this other thing. You know, so that sort of distraction and all of the activity that's going on might be a good opportunity for you to be able to reach out to someone and say, hey, I know you're really busy. Have you thought about slowing down for a second and such and such? But we have these opportunities. We have a lot of opportunity to grow in this area. So let's put it into practice. Make some progress this week. See what you can do to stir others up. Let us consider one another to provoke to love and to good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much more as you see the day approaching.